Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, I'll introduce you to New Orleans' own White House-appointed culinary state diplomat, Sucre chef Tarik Hanna. We'll learn just what that new honor means for him and where he derives his sweet inspiration. Then we'll travel to Montana for meat cookery advice with Chef Jay Bentley. And Momofuku's David Chang is back with Fried Chicken Chat. It's all guys, all the time, on this week's Louisiana Eats. Sucre chef Tarik Hanna's adventurous spirit and intense natural curiosity has served him well in life. You never know where a conversation with the British-educated Tarik will lead. Tarik, I've heard it said that the work you do at Sucre involves everything you know, but nothing you've ever seen before. So I'd like for you to tell me a little bit about your own personal creative process.
There is no rhyme or reason as to how it happens. I'm just a cook. Who gets crazy ideas.
Yeah, you're a pretty fancy cook, Mister.
But what inspires me? Multiple things. First of all, the people I work with, the crew that I work with, the team of incredible cooks that I work with, the people that I have worked with. I was never fortunate enough to work for a pastry chef. I always was the pastry chef. So I'm relatively self-taught, so I have to draw from the inspiration of what I see around me. I've never wanted to pigeonhole myself as being either a restaurant pastry chef by doing plated desserts or just doing chocolates or just doing confections. I've always wanted to do everything because, quite frankly, I get bored very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I always have to keep things interesting. And if I get bored with one thing, I know I have something else to go to. So my process has simply been everything from Twix, the perfect combination of crunch, caramel, and chocolate. I mean, can anyone deny that it's such an amazing piece of technological achievement in confection? No, it's the greatest candy bar ever. To donuts. I mean, I remember I was so inspired by, fascinated by donuts when I first moved to the States that what did I do? I went and worked at Dunkin' Donuts. I worked at Dunkin' Donuts for 6 months because I wanted to learn everything about donuts. So I wanted to understand how to be a better line cook. So I became a short order cook. And I met probably one of the most incredibly talented cooks working as a short order cook. This guy could remember so many orders, flip so many eggs, get every order correct, work at such a lightning pace, and make it look so effortless. That in all my years working in fine dining, I never saw anybody who could remotely touch this guy. So it was somewhat of an irreverent approach to what I do. And I have to also say that I had no food involvement before I moved to the States other than consuming. I accidentally ended up in culinary school. So I am a 100% American chef. And 100% American pastry chef. I'm not a French-trained, European-trained, none of that. I am an American-trained, American-taught, and I'm a true American chef, as you can tell by my accent.
Well, it really surprised me when I discovered that on the Sucre website, you all give out your recipes. Now, how can you part with these trade secrets?
Because I stole it from someone else.
And besides, maybe they'll try it and figure out it's not as
easy as you think. I have one of my interns today, I was showing him how to cast chocolate molds. And there's something that's very mechanical about it, that you go through the motions and then you watch a student try to do it. And it's somewhat of a clumsy feat. And in the back of my mind, I have to say, like, it's not as easy as it looks.
That's true.
So that's why, I mean, we all share recipes. Like, when I was in Switzerland, we were all sharing recipes and tricks. And it's funny, we spent 3 days speaking about macaroons because every single one of us run into the same problems at various times of the year. So we are all sharing ideas and how to counteract these problems.
Tarek, what's the most difficult thing you've ever made?
The most difficult thing I ever made was the commitment to move to New Orleans and open Sucre, but it was the best decision I ever made.
That's a very good answer. I was half expecting you to say, I haven't made it yet. It's ahead of me.
In terms of products, everything is impossible until you do it for the first time.
Gotcha.
I like using that on my staff when I give them new tasks and they look at me like deers in a headlight. And I say, at first, all things are impossible until you do them for the first time.
Well, recently, you were called to Washington, D.C. and given the honor of becoming a culinary diplomat of the state. What does that designation mean exactly?
It means I can run red lights. It means I can park wherever I want. And no, I wish.
Really?
This all came about through our involvement with Mayor Landrieu. For the last couple of years, he has done the economic initiative where we've had foreign diplomats come to New Orleans and basically show them how a city can come back from such a disastrous event and rebuild itself, reinvent itself bigger and better through commerce and culture. And so as representatives of New Orleans culture and food culture, we were the ones that essentially were called upon to treat them. But as a result of that, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had come to the realization in her years at the White House how food will make or break a negotiation. Mm-hmm. When they have state dinners and they have, whether it's a large event or a smaller intimate dinner, and these are tense negotiations, sometimes if they get the food right, it yields positive results. And if the food is wrong, sometimes they have to start over.
That's fascinating.
So they found that there was an incredible link between food and diplomacy. So what they decided to do was to develop through, and this is in association with the James Beard Foundation, to develop the Diplomatic Culinary Partnership, where 20 of us have been named as the inaugural ambassadors for the U.S. culinary industry. And it could be anything from, if there is a foreign diplomat who is coming to the country or coming to our area, I'll be called upon to do a dinner for them. Or if I happen to be going to a foreign country, if I'm going to Brazil, I will notify the State Department. They will set up, whether it's a speaking engagement or some form of cultural exchange. So it's just such an incredibly humbling position to hold, especially from the standpoint of, I moved here 26 years ago as a foreign student. In 26 years, and again, I'm being a little selfish, maybe a little dramatic when I say this, but I think more than anybody, I have truly realized what the true American dream is. And that's simply, whatever you want, you can have if you're willing to work for it.
That's it.
And in 26 years, I've gone from a kid who had no idea what he wanted to do in life to, in 2004, becoming the ACF first ever Central Region Pastry Chef of the Year, becoming the runner-up National Pastry Chef of the Year for the ACF that year. So, I mean, being second best out of several thousand is not bad.
No.
To moving to New Orleans and just the embrace that I got from the community and everyone, from you to the critics, to the customers, to everybody, and just how warm the welcome has been and how embracing it's been. I would never trade that for anything. If I had never received another award in my life, I've received the greatest award, and that's to be welcomed into a new community and people appreciating what it is that I'm trying to offer them. And then one of my lifelong goals, my career-long goals, was to make it onto a particular list. And last year, I made it onto the 10 best pastry chefs in America for Dessert Professional Magazine, which is sort of like the the gospel for pastry chefs.
It's amazing where a little something sweet will take you.
I know. Huh? And it's all because of cake. You make someone a cake and they open the world up to you. There's nothing else I could do to top this. When you move to this country as an immigrant and you end up walking through the halls of the White House and the State Department and you're getting honored by the highest form of power, I have to say on earth. I mean, where else can I go?
Well, you made it onto Louisiana Eats.
That's where else I can go. And that's where I am right now. So,
thank you.
So I can die a very, very happy man right now. I have achieved every goal in life.
I couldn't resist. Thank you. Thank you, Tarek. It's just great having you out here.
Thank you
finally.
Very much.
And I can't wait to taste the next sweet thing that comes out of your kitchen. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Poppy, for having me.
Chef Tarek Hanna of Supreme. I gotta have sweet. There's just no telling what a satisfied man might do. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is a fourth-generation sausage maker with Jazz Fest in his blood.
They basically asked my dad to make some po' boys. He'd wrap them up in foil at the restaurant, and he would bring them out to the booth. My dad used to say there were more musicians walking around that festival than there were patrons. But it was they had an air at that first festival. It was... I think the people that were there knew that this was something special.
Although he had a corporate job lined up with Kraft General Foods after graduation, our hero decided to come home and go to work with his dad in the family business.
Having a generational business that keeps going and going, it's rare. I made the decision to go back, to come back home and really give it a try. Now, of course, working with my dad was... let's say being baptized by fire, because if we didn't argue or fuss every day, I thought something was wrong. But it was a part of that whole concept of theory from college that I learned and his many years of just hands-on learning and trial and tribulation.
His decision to return as the fourth generation of his family's sausage business was one he never regretted.
7 years that I had working side by side with him before he had his heart attack were some of the greatest years I had, because I realized after he left that I didn't have that time coming up because he worked all the time. And then having those 7 years of arguing with him every day, he was training me. He was toughening my skin. He was getting me ready.
At the time of his dad's sudden death, the father-son team had worked hard to secure a major new contract for their business.
Well, he had his heart attack right outside of Ochsner. They had about 7 orderlies and different people to pick him up and get him to the emergency room because he was quite a large man. And there was a moment in there where when they came in and they told me, that's when I knew you got to have to step up. And so that night, I spent the night with my mom at the home. It was just she and I, and we were laying in the bed together, just looking at the ceiling, talking and trying to figure out what we were going to do. And she says, well, what are you going to do? I says, well, knowing my dad, I got to get up at 5 and go start loading these trucks. We worked so hard on this contract. I said, I can't let this stop. So it wasn't any morning time for me. I walked in there, all the people that were waiting for me. I said, well, Sonny's not coming. He passed yesterday. I says, but knowing him, we got to keep this going. So I opened up the door to the factory. I broke down and cried for about 5 minutes, wiped my tears, and we started loading the trucks, and the rest is history.
That's why Vance Beaucresson is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support by Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Save room for a Beaucresson hot sausage poor boy, because that's real Louisiana Eats. After a short break, we'll visit the Open Range with Chef Jay Bentley. Jay had his culinary start right here in the Bayou State, so the Natchitoches meat pies he serves at his Belgrade, Montana restaurant are authentic Louisiana eats. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Jay Bentley is the chef, owner, and proprietor of the Mint Cafe and Bar in Belgrade, Montana. But when it comes to his approach with food, he's got a very strong Louisiana vibe running right through it. So, Jay, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thanks, Poppy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get started by discussing your New Orleans roots. Describe sort of how you've got that influence in your food.
Well, my brother Tony was the racetrack announcer at the fairgrounds for years, and this was way back in the 80s, early 80s. Maybe it was 1980. I was down there, and I ran into Danielle Bonneau.
The great Chef Danielle.
Oh, he's the best. He's still great. And, you know, I kind of had always wanted to open a restaurant. I was in the real estate business at the time. So I said, well, Danielle, what does it take, I mean, to work in your kitchen?
Because at that time, he had Louis the 16th, which was such a trendsetter here.
It was. But he said, you know, you don't steal from me, you show up on time, you got a job. So obviously the qualifications were not particularly stringent. It was a great experience. He's a tough guy in the kitchen, as he should be. But I learned a lot from him, and it gave me the basis for it to actually change my whole life. So when I came back to Montana, you know, I opened this kind of little French restaurant in a town of 600 on the Madison River, and everybody was so blown away, they didn't know what to think. And we ended up, you know, doing well for years and years with lots of famous people who, you know, who all like to trout fish.
Before we move on, what was your motivation to write the book? Why did you think this book needed to be written?
Well, first of all, the winters in Montana are very long.
Yeah. I said, gave you something to do.
Because, you know what? Am I going to sit around all winter, or am I going to do something? So I started writing this book 5 or 6 years ago. Originally, it was a concept, I was just going to call it Real Red Meat. And it was all about meat. But then the more I decided to expand it, I thought it would be a lot more interesting to have what it has, what it contains, these different kinds of recipes. And, you know, we just kind of changed the concept a little. I came up with this open range, which, of course, if you're not familiar with it, it's a term that goes back to the late 1870s when there were no fences. The ranchers all had these huge herds of cattle, and they roamed everywhere, and they didn't use barbed wire. That's why they branded them, so they would know whose belonged to who. And I really like the idea of that title because it kind of means no boundaries in a way. To make a long story short, you know, it just kind of came together, and I was very lucky to have the production people at Running Press.
Well, you know, I find that your description of Montana very interesting. You say that it's a place where people like their steaks big and their drinks dark. So how was that French food flying in the face of that?
Well, you know, it's so funny because I was looking at an old Louis XVI menu that I have on my wall, and I see in there We used to do a Cote de Boeuf for two, and this was 1980, and it was $39.50. Staggering amount of money in those days.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, when I got to Montana, it was interesting because I would do things like sweetbreads, which Danielle would do fairly often there, and these old ranchers would come in, and they'd never heard of them, and they'd sit down, and suddenly they'd love it. You find that good food is universally appreciated, and I think that was a great lesson for me.
So you were expanding people's culinary horizons out there under that big sky, huh?
Absolutely. It's a great place to live, and it's a great place to have a restaurant.
Well, it's very curious that we began this conversation talking about your time here in Louisiana, because I don't think anybody would think of Louisiana and Montana as being related. So what sort of cultural and culinary differences and similarities have you stumbled on?
Well, first of all, when I was in New Orleans, Paul Prudhomme had opened Cape Paul's a couple of years before that, and it was the blackening rage. Everything was blackened, and although most of the people that tried to imitate him never pulled it off as well as he did, they always put too much seasoning on and everything. But it was interesting because I really got into cooking on cast iron. And so over the years in my restaurants, I found that with cast iron, it's a great way to do steaks or anything like that because it gives you the opportunity to put a great char on the outside to kind of regulate the way it cooks. For example, a thick rib steak.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you just put it on this red-hot cast iron and mark it, or you kind of sear both sides, and then you finish it in an oven. And it's a really great way to do it. Keeps the juices in, and I just have never tried any other way that I like better than that. So consequently, over the years, that's what I do. I do a lot of cast iron in my restaurant. It's interesting because this cast iron thing is very much like the cooking of Argentina. In Argentina, they call it a plancha or a chapa, which is basically their word for cast iron griddle. So there's a lot of similarity between those. And frankly, I think New Orleans is the greatest food in the world, and it was a great opportunity for me to expose the people up here to those things, barbecue shrimp, corn mock shoe, things like that. It was a lot of fun to open those horizons for these people.
Jay, I loved your section in the book on the history of meat in Montana because it's such a fascinating progression of how it's gone over the last 100 years, because cattle came in and the bison almost went extinct. But now there's a tremendous reversal going on in that too, isn't there?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. Wherever there's a lot of grass, whether it's Argentina, whether it's Africa, or whether it's the Western United States, basically that's the whole evolutionary episode. In the beginning, there were buffalo everywhere, and eventually they were almost, eliminated. So then the next phase was where the longhorn cattle that were driven up from Texas.
Yeah.
They were really tough and, frankly, pretty tough to eat as well, but they were very hardy and they survived the climate and everything. And eventually, they evolved into more the Hereford and the Angus strain we have today. But the great thing about it is guys like Ted Turner came in, 15 years ago and started buying ranches. Well, not guys like Ted, but Ted.
He's fairly unique.
Yeah, he's a great guy, by the way. He's done a lot for the state. So he started raising buffalo or bison, and now quite a few ranches are doing it. And there's a great market for it. It's healthy. It's basically naturally raised meat.
So it has a really important place on your menu.
It does. And, it's the kind of thing where you're starting to see it in actually the corner grocery store now.
Well, I was surprised to find recipes for Moskva's chicken a la grande and Natchitoches meat pies in the book. So, why did you think it was important to include them?
Well, it's interesting. For example, the meat pies, there's also a recipe in the book called Butte Pasties. They're basically meat pies as well. They come from the cuisine of the Welsh miners that used to mine copper and silver in Butte, Montana. And their wives would make those pasties for lunch every day, and they'd stick them in their lunch buckets. And the only difference essentially between the two is ones in Louisiana are fried, and the other ones that they use in Montana were baked. So there was a connection there. I just think people love good food no matter where they are, and if they're exposed to different ideas, I think they love to try it, you know?
I imagine your Montana eaters just are eating up your Louisiana dishes, huh?
Oh, no, everybody loves the book, and I'll tell you why everybody likes it, because the recipes actually work. You know, they're not something mysterious. The ingredients are relatively easy to get. And the nice thing about it, if you just follow the recipe, it's going to taste good.
Well, Jay, there was something a little mysterious to me. And I would like to touch on this with you, because personally, I'm kind of known for gumbo around these parts.
Right.
Jay, what in the heck is this beef gumbo? I've had a lot of gumbos, but I've never seen a beef gumbo. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I used to have a lot of leftover prime rib, and I wanted to figure out some way to do it. And I love gumbo, and my favorite normally is like andouille and chicken and chunks of ham in it. But I wanted a way to use up some of that leftover prime rib, and I just like gumbo. You know, I like the sassafras and the thyme, and I like the flavors. And it was just a matter of kind of giving it a little Montana twist.
Well, I have to admit, I'm fascinated by that concept, and I'm going to give your beef gumbo a try. And I just want to thank you so much for joining us so that the Louisiana Eats listeners could have a peek into the food scene of Montana.
Oh, yeah, it's a great place. And, you know, we get a lot of people from New Orleans and Louisiana up here for fishing and for skiing in the winter up at Big Sky and Bridger Bowl, some of our ski areas that are close by.
Well, it's a great ambition of mine, so I hope to see you there one day.
Well, I would love to see you, too, and maybe I would be able to cook some of that beef gumbo for you when you show up.
Okay, that's a deal. Thank you, Jay. Jay Bentley, author of Open Range. This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl. Ah! See! Author of Louisiana Rambles, food writer, and public radio contributor Ian McNulty is our own personal authority on what to eat in every little nook and cranny of Louisiana. Ian, welcome back. And what have you got today?
Well, thanks, Poppy. Great to be here. I'm going to give you a report on what's brewing up to be a Boudin ball war in central Cajun country.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Now, we've been seeing Boudin balls turn up all over the place around New Orleans. I see them in restaurants a lot more often now. And to be clear, you know, for those who are uninitiated, we're talking about basically Boudin filling, that rice and spice and pork that are breaded and deep fried, sort of like Cajun croquettes, you know, about the size of a baseball at their finest form, I think. Typically sold at your Cajun butcher shops and gas stations. Though, like I say, these days, there are plenty of restaurant menus in the cities.
Oh, white tablecloth.
Absolutely. White tablecloth Boudin balls. But before all of this, one of the more reliable places to get Boudin balls was the town of Crotch Springs, a tiny little town on Highway 190.
Yes.
In St. Landry Parish there, about halfway between Baton Rouge and Opelousas. If you've heard of Crotch Springs before, you know it's famous for two things. One, a speed trap. Notorious speed trap.
Notorious.
Watch your odometer as you're crossing the bridge into Crotch Springs. And the other is boudin balls. Now, back in the dark ages, before we could get boudin balls a lot more readily, if you knew someone who was driving through, you might ask them to pick you up a bag of boudin balls there. Friends who had truck driving routes were especially high demand for this sort of thing for their regular trips through. Now, a boudin ball that's been in a paper sack like that delivered to you, it's still pretty good, but it's not ideal. Ideal is when it's eaten out of hand in the parking lot of the place that made them.
Hot and crispy.
Exactly. And that's good because the places around to get them around Crotch Springs are pretty bare bones. I mean, they're basically like gas stations. What's interesting now, though, is there seems to be sort of this arms race going on for new interpretations of what a boudin ball can be, really stretching the limits of the boudin ball.
What else can a boudin ball be?
Okay, so you've heard of crawfish boudin, right?
But I've never seen it in a ball.
Well, they've been making them as crawfish balls for quite a while now in Crotch Springs, it turns out. But it really goes on from there. Chicken balls, deer balls, even, Poppy, turducken balls?
No. Okay, no. Now, what is a turducken ball? Describe.
Well, turkey, duck, and chicken, all that meat, mounded together into like a big meatball and fried. Some of these have rice, like a proper boudin ball. Others don't. They're more like kind of like spicy meatballs. More like kind of take the form of boudin balls. But whatever, they're excellent car food. You know,
I bet.
Cruising along, yeah. You know how some gas stations compete on the price of a gallon of gas?
Yes.
These places in Crotch Springs seem to be competing on their boudin balls. The contenders are the Crotch Springs Canal Station, which is a gas station with a little takeout restaurant attached to it. That's called the Cajun Corner Cafe. And right across the street, there's Billy's. That's been a famous place for boudin balls for a long time. Last time I went through, they had pepper jack boudin balls at Billy's. These were really good. Of course, just that spicy cheese inside melts into these stretchy wads all throughout the orb of the boudin ball. Just up the street, a little closer to the bridge there, there's Karchner's Grocery. And this is like your full-service Cajun butcher shop. Everything from stuffed rabbit and duck to those marinated quail eggs. You know, you can do your whole shopping list here. And, of course, boudin, including deer boudin, chicken boudin. And their own contribution to the boudin ball wars, little fried numbers with both jalapeno and cream cheese mixed in with the boudin. Actually, you probably should not be driving when you're eating one of these things. Just save that for the parking lot. So what I love about this little town, though, I mean, this is a blink-if-you-miss-it stretch of Highway 190.
Oh, it's a little grease spot.
Definitely, yeah. But while you're here, I mean, you can, with a U-turn and a few different parking spots, sample the entire range just on a little spin through, fill a basket with some of these things and sample them with some of your friends in the car. But like in the old days, just remember to bring a few home for your friends. Otherwise, with chicken balls and deer balls and crawfish balls, they might not even believe you.
That is the most incredible story. This is one of those only in Louisiana, isn't it?
Thank goodness it is, yes.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter Ian McNulty. We'll be back with Chef David Chang of New York's Momofuku Restaurant to chat fried chicken and more. Stay tuned. I'm on my way to New Orleans this morning. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. We've had so much seafood talk lately on Louisiana Eats that I thought you might like to have my personal tartar sauce recipe. Much of my free time is spent at our fishing camp in Bayron Kiel, where the trout and redfish just about jump in the boat. For years, inevitably on the camp's dinner table, there was a jar or squeeze bottle of some commercially made tartar sauce. Over time, no matter which brand I tried, they all tasted more like chemicals than food. When was the last time you read a tartar sauce label? Have a look, and you'll discover most brands include monosodium glutamate, potassium sorbate, xanthan gum, calcium chloride, calcium disodium ETA, and yellow food coloring number 5 to make you think it's rich and eggy, but it's not. Sounds pretty yummy, huh? I don't want to put those chemicals in my body, much less feed them to my family. So are you ready for some good tartar sauce? It's easy, and you probably already have the ingredients in your fridge. Make a fresh mayonnaise by whisking together an egg yolk and the juice of a lemon, then slowly incorporate a cup of light vegetable oil, whisking it all together until it's thick and creamy. Or just scoop out a cup or so of your favorite prepared mayonnaise. Chop up a tablespoon of drained capers, dice up 5 or 6 little gherkin pickles, and mix them into the mayo. Add some fresh chopped parsley. If it's to your taste, add some chopped green onions or a finely minced garlic clove. Spice it up with a couple of dashes of hot sauce, and then stir in the juice of a lemon. Trust me, this is some delicious tartar sauce. For a copy of this recipe or to have a look at our Louisiana Eats recipe collection, visit our website online at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. New York chef David Chang of the Momofuku Restaurant Empire has quite a reputation for being a no-holds-barred, highly awarded, and highly opinionated chef who's never worried about creating a stir in the pot or in the food world. Food & Wine, Bon Appetit, GQ, and James Beard have all lauded him as best chef. David, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
How you doing? Thank you for having me.
So, since we're speaking to you from Louisiana, I'd like to start off with fried chicken. How did you become so obsessed with it?
Number one, who doesn't like fried chicken? I don't even like people that like just the fried chicken that's only white meat. White meat fried chicken people I don't even like. You know what I mean?
Yes, dear. We're in the same bed with that. I'm a dark meat girl.
Something's wrong with them. I'd rather them be a vegetarian or something.
Okay, now let's talk about this fried chicken dinner at Momofuku Noodle Bar.
There's a healthy competition amongst the cooks and all the chefs at all the restaurants. And long story cut short, Peter Serpico, the chef at Co., and myself had a competition who could make the best fried chicken. And then it turned into who could make the most unique fried chicken, who could make the crispiest fried chicken. And it was a lot of trash talking. You know, my chicken skin is going to be so intense that you're going to shatter your teeth on it, you know. And it reached a crescendo of just total ridiculousness. And then when we actually cooked this battle between the two of us, we both decided, wow, both chickens are extraordinarily delicious. So why don't we try to put this on the menu somewhere? And the menu that the environment that seemed to suit the best was Noodle Bar. So, you know, I did a riff on Korean fried chicken, which is sort of like a triple fried chicken. And that's the long and short of a weird chicken story.
So tell us about the connections that you have found between Southern food and Korean and Asian cuisine.
The way I look at Southern food is, while I was born in Virginia, all the people from the Southern Foodway Alliance, they give me a hard time for not really being from Virginia because I'm more from the Washington, D.C. area.
Uh-huh.
I'm south of the Mason-Dixon line. But, you know, I'm one of those guys that spent a lot of time in Richmond, and I feel like once you hit Richmond, then you're properly in the South. So I spent a lot of time there. A lot of my early food memories were just eating things that I didn't really know what I was eating until I re-encounter grits later in life and stuff like that. So it was sort of a connection that I didn't really make until I started cooking professionally. And also, I tried to imagine, what if, say, my ancestors, or not necessarily my ancestors, or Japanese people or Chinese people moved to Charleston 300 years ago? Because it was, at the time, one of the most cosmopolitan southern ports.
True.
Very diverse.
That and New Orleans.
And New Orleans. I always use Charleston. Forgive me. New Orleans. Actually, New Orleans is a perfect example when you think about cuisines merging and just literally the melting pot of French, African, everything, just turning into not just one type of food, but many different things. And, you know, that takes time, and that takes awareness of culinary traditions and merging them, and, you know, that is fusion. All food is fusion, if you think about it.
Yeah, I love
it. Takes time.
I love the way that you describe what you do as American cuisine. I love that the way that you have embraced and melded the Asian with the American and made it distinctly.
Right, exactly. And that's what I try to hope some of our flavors at our restaurants taste like, is if you use your imagination, and if I did have ancestors that were in New Orleans, how would they cook Korean food?
Our mutual friend, food writer Brett Anderson, says that he knows from personal experience you wish you could drink like a Southerner. Now, what's Brett talking about?
Well, there is something to be said about Southern cities. Not all Southern cities, but cities that are like New Orleans, Charleston, Savannah, Athens. People just drink. It's not, you know, if you have two glasses of wine at lunch, people are like, oh, my God, what are you doing?
And here, we expect you to have two martinis.
Yeah. I think it's a great thing, because it's, you would expect it to be conservative and all this stuff, but it's not. And when I had dinner, it was like, what do you want to drink? That's what the first thing people always ask is, what do you want to drink? Food is very important, but drinking, you better bring your drink.
Yeah.
Bring your drink on in the South.
Amen.
Particularly in New Orleans, which I've been spending some time in, and I thought I was ready, but I feel like I've gotten a lot of my drinking days behind me. You know, I had a fake ID when I was like 13 years old. I don't even want to know what my liver looks like, but, you know, I don't drink nearly as much as I used to, but which is why when I go down to New Orleans or any proper southern city, even like Louisville, I was there recently, I was like, good Lord, man, the drinking, it just seems outrageous, because it's all the time, and I think it's fantastic, because it lends itself to a more laid-back, less serious approach to life, and, you know, people think, oh, it's just getting drunk, but no, usually when you're drinking, you're with your friends, you're with family, you're not by yourself in a cubicle, or sitting by yourself in a New York bar because it's happy hour and you're just pounding drinks.
It's a social thing.
Yeah, drinking in the South is a social thing. I think the rest of America just will understand.
Well, when you leave New Orleans, is there anything that you crave from here when you get back to New York?
There really is music being played all the time. But I just have to think that people are happier in New Orleans when they're going out, whether they're tourists visiting or local. Like, I was with a cab driver, and she didn't know me from anything. It was in the suburbs or whatever, Lakeside. I had to get my computer fixed, and she just told me the greatest story. She's like, oh, you just missed Jazz Fest. Oh, that's too bad. You know, Mardi Gras is amazing. You know, people always say no one ever meets their love of their life in Mardi Gras, but I've been married to my husband now in like 40 some odd years. And she had been born and raised in some town in Oklahoma, and she had come as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old girl to have a fun time in Mardi Gras, and she's been here ever since. And she was telling me these amazing stories, and that's the one thing about New Orleans is the locals, the people that live there, they can spin a tale. And some are amazingly funny, and some are tragically sad, and that's life, and they can just live it. And she's just a cab driver, and she stopped out of her way to show me the levees that broke and how high the water was here or there, and that I was shocked, you know?
Yeah.
No cab driver in New York would ever tell me, like, this is where such and such happened. There's a lot of love for that city. A lot of love.
And we love our visitors. We love it when you guys come. So
crazy.
Tell me about your new publishing project, Lucky Peach.
Well, Peter Meehan has helped to create this journal that was a companion to this iPad app that we've been filming with 0.0. They produced Tony Bourdain's No Reservations. So we wanted to do something that was educational, that showed how some ideas are created, and we were so lucky to have some amazing writers. Like, anytime you get John T. Edge to write something, and Ruth Reichel, and, you know, the list goes on and on, why wouldn't you not try to assemble some type of journal?
Okay, we have to let everybody know the answer to this. Why did you call it Lucky Peach?
Besides Momofuku sounding like something ridiculous that you might hear on the street here in New York, it also roughly translates to something called Lucky Peach. So it was something that we always play around with in terms of the meaning. And we just thought it was a good name for a journal and good name for a lot of other things as well.
Okay, I got one more question for you, because you and I are just meeting through this call today, and I got to tell you what, you sound like a pretty happy Lucky Peach to me. I read that back in 2009, you said you realized that you were just too angry. And so what is that about? And what did you do to stop being too angry, and what makes you angry now?
Well, I don't think many people would describe me as happy, but when I'm in New Orleans, I'm happy. When I'm traveling, I'm happy. But I take the kitchen world relatively serious stuff, and it's not that I'm not happy. It's just that I work better in a very focused, concentrated state. And I just want to focus on food, and if there's anything that's not food-related, or if you're not on the bus, I would get mad. You know, I realize it wasn't the most effective way for me, and it wasn't something that I can continue to do to work. You know, while that type of work environment might have helped me get to where we are today, it wasn't going to provide any type of longevity. So things could have all been different if we opened up in New Orleans, man. I've gotten to know a lot of the chefs down there. And even people that are just opening up some small spots, people are just chill, man. They're content, and I'm envious of that.
Well, come on down here and be happy with us. We'd love to have you.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you, David. Thanks so much for taking the time for us today.
No worries. Thank you for having me here on your show.
Award-winning chef David Chang of the Momofuku Restaurant and the new publication, Lucky Peach. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll take a romp through the wild world of thoroughly Southern writer Julia Reed.
You know, when I was a kid in the Delta, we'd either go north to Memphis or south to New Orleans, depending on how much time we wanted to spend in the car. And New Orleans usually won. People sort of think, well, if we leave now, we can get to Galatoire's, you know, in time for dinner or whatever. And then I came for Jazz Fest, and I heard myself saying at about 3 o'clock in the morning after a post-Jazz Fest party, oh yeah, I'm getting an apartment here.
Subscribe to our podcast. Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickey Brennan and Company, Lightsegan and Westside Lightsegan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.